UW School for Workers is the oldest labor education program in the nation, celebrating its 100th anniversary in 2025. Why was a school for workers started, and how has it evolved over time? I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year. Joining me are two faculty members from the School for Workers. Don Taylor is chair of the department and a nationally recognized expert on the constitutional rights of public employees. Professor Erica Wills was honored recently with the Andrew Purnell Trailblazer Award for her commitment to workers' rights, union advocacy, and community-engaged scholarship. Welcome to both of you to University of the Year.
Thank you.
So the School for Workers has quite a history, you know, hitting the 100th mark from 2025, started in 1925. That's a long history. And I know we're going to be talking about why it got started here at UW, what the School for Workers does. I'm curious, before we get to that point, to hear a little bit from both of you about what drew you into the field of labor studies, becoming part of a school for workers. Maybe I'll start with you, Erica. So, you know, you went to college and somehow you wound up in this professorship having to do with labor studies within the School for Workers. What drew you there?
Sure. And I can tell you a little bit about how I ended up in labor studies and also why I chose to come to the School for Workers. Some of my earliest memories are of my grandfather, who was a factory worker who worked directly with asbestos, raw asbestos products. And he died at a young age of asbestosis mesothelioma. And this probably impacted me more than I knew as a six-year-old child when he passed away. And I went through school, I went through college, I studied at several different universities and explored different paths and was always drawn back to workers' rights as human rights. And specifically the way that we tell workers' stories and include their voices in the narratives and the historical documentation that we have. And so as I went into my PhD program, which was actually in English studies, I increasingly focused on looking at texts that had to do with worker stories and collecting oral histories of workers and integrating those together in my scholarship and my outreach. So I began working directly with different labor organizations and unions and their workers who were facing a multitude of issues that were similar to what my grandfather had faced and had very much impacted my family to this day. So as I graduated and was looking for a job, I was very much drawn into adult education, education with union members and workers, which I'm very committed to because I think oftentimes they can be an underserved population, as well as continuing my research in that area. And the School for Workers was an excellent fit. Its dedication to doing those things and a commitment to worker education made it a very natural and ideal place for me to end up.
That's really inspiring. And it does seem as if the School for Workers epitomizes the Wisconsin idea, the sense that the university really should be serving the state as a whole, not just traditional students in a college classroom in Madison.
Absolutely. And one of the areas that I'm currently working on through a grant from the university to do Wisconsin idea work is that it extends beyond Wisconsin, even across the nation, that we take our expertise and we can use it to help different populations as a whole. And so I'm looking at the impact of coal phase-out and clean energy transition on the Navajo Nation and the way it has impacted that sometimes under-recognized group of workers. And so it is a implementation and expansion of the Wisconsin idea to serve those populations and collaborate with them as well.
And Don, what about you, your journey to being, you're now chair of the School for Workers department.
I think perhaps my story may be less inspiring, but I grew up in a paper mill town in northern New Hampshire where it was a union culture would be an understatement because it was one of those towns where the one industry was the core of the city. And so everything was about the paper workers union. fast forward, I finished grad school, wasn't exactly sure what I wanted to do with my life, and asked myself, what's a change the world type of job that doesn't pay poverty wages? And I said, I know, I can be a union organizer. And I was fortunate enough to get a job with the United Electrical, Radio, and Machine Workers, who go by the abbreviation UE, who have a very deep and interesting history themselves, as an organizer and contract negotiator and representative. And then after a while, I changed jobs to the Boston Hotel Workers Union and worked for them for a bit doing similar work, not just doing the work, but teaching workers how to represent themselves in meetings with their managers, or how to sit at the table and negotiate, and or leadership skills, which are all the things we do here at the School for Workers. And then ultimately ended up for several years with the State Employees Union back in my home state of New Hampshire. And through all of those jobs, did all the things that the School for Workers does, except in each case I was doing it for one union, one population. And so when this opportunity at the School for Workers came up, I said, well, there's a good fit for me, because I get to take everything I've learned with these unions that I've worked with over the years and broaden it to literally the entire labor movement in Wisconsin and beyond, so that any union member that walks into my classroom can be further developed as a leader and activist by what I've learned over the course of my career. So that's how I ended up at the School for Workers, after saying I was never going to leave New Hampshire again.
In your list of publications and topics that you are involved in things having to do with athletic shoes.
Yes, and that's actually as a result of my town. It being overwhelmingly a paper industry city, the second largest employer was a Converse sneaker factory, which at its peak got up to about 1,200 employees, which is not insignificant in a town of less than 20,000. And I started from a point of just wanting to know more about it. I knew that it had they'd had a strike and then closed. So as I began researching it, it developed into a book project, and I won't go on and on, but one of the turning points was when I went to the local historical society and found that the volunteers who ran the historical society were a married couple who had worked at the Converse plant. And so they began calling everybody they knew and creating interview schedules for me that they would hand me on a daily basis. And that's when I realized that I had a book project on my hands. And so, yeah, I've become an expert on the globalization of the U.S. sneaker industry as a result, just by examining the history of this one factory that had been in my hometown until 1979.
Maybe we'll loop back around to that in a bit, but that's fascinating to take two people who are both in the School for Workers but came at it from different angles. Let's talk about the School for Workers itself and its history. Why did it get started in 1925 at the University of Wisconsin? Why start a school for workers?
Well, it actually started outside the university for a very brief period of time. It was a project of the Madison YWCA that developed a summer school for women in industry. And the idea was it wasn't at the time a training in union skills or union leadership. It was an opportunity for women who worked in factory jobs to come to the university for an entire summer and take university classes. And then within a year or two, the university took it over, and I don't mean that in a hostile way. And that's when it became, you know, the University of Wisconsin Summer School for Women in Industry, and the door was open to men, and it continued to evolve from there. And that's to connect back to the, this year, as part of our anniversary, we hosted the Summer School for Working Women. Midwest School for Working Women, and we intentionally chose to do that in our anniversary year because we had originated as the Summer School for Women in Industry, to make that explicit connection.
And can you say something, Erica, you've been involved with looking at women in industry too. Was this pretty specifically for blue-collar women workers that were in factory-type jobs, or was it women in any field?
This oftentimes was for women who were in more of blue-collar employees, but not exclusively. It comes out of a tradition that at Bryn Mawr that established this and had a structure that was sort of reproduced across the United States. And as Don alluded to it, it continues today. We hosted the 100th, as part of our 100th anniversary celebration, the Midwest School for Women Workers, who is affiliated with an organization called the United Association for Labor Education. And UALE, as its abbreviation is, has four regional women's summer schools that they host. And universities or labor organizations partner, and each state hosts it a different year. And so we hosted it for the Midwest this year. And it is still focuses on giving women workers not only what may be considered blue-collar, perhaps, workers. But we had a variety of workers who came there. We had some union workers, some non-union workers. We had workers in the tech industry, and we had workers on auto assembly lines. We had an amazing cross-section. I think we had five Midwestern states that were represented there, and a variety of women who came together really in a place and space that I don't know another way that they all would have met each other. And the one thing that they had in common is they self-identified as women workers, whatever that means to them, and were able to share their knowledge and experience with each other and learn from each other, as well as learning from the sessions that we had and the curriculum that we provided. And I think that there's still a very interesting, unique space for that to continue to happen across the U.S. and in the Midwest. It happens every summer.
When I think about women workers, several things come to mind. One is for me, raising three children was the hardest work of all. I mean, so there's women's work that doesn't even get counted as labor, but it's there. There's also this long history, and it continues, of women being underpaid or excluded from certain fields. When the YWCA and Bryn Mawr and then ultimately UW began this summer school for worker women that worked, was it with any aim for equity, for empowerment? You know, what was the goal then, to have women come and learn what and do what and change in what ways?
At the beginning, it was, education for workers, I think, was seen more as a human uplift, to help people better themselves generally. I don't know for sure, but I don't think there was for lack of a better term, a political agenda in terms of, teaching women how to advocate for themselves as women or woman empowerment. But that certainly developed as history unfolded. And getting back to your question about whether things were just factory workers, that was part of the evolution as well. We've actually very intentionally focused our historical focus this year on adaptations and transformation, rather than thinking of our history in terms of just the general history of the School for Workers. And as the nature of the workforce has changed, as the nature of work has changed, the School for Workers has a really strong record of adapting to meet the needs of workers. And as, for example, as white-collar work became more prevalent in our economy, which, of course, depending on the job, it was often female-gendered work, we expanded into that area. And when it didn't happen immediately, but that eventually led to questions of pay equity, and we ended up working in that area as well, as the in-house experts, so to speak, on the workers' side of the equation.
And what kind of early success did the School for Workers have? I mean, if something lasts for 100 years, it's usually because something is working, something is succeeding. There's merit that's recognized. If you look at those early years, the 1920s, 1930s, leading up to World War II, what were some early successes that happened that made people think, it's good UW has a school for workers?
I think specifically with the time period that you're talking about, that correlates in U.S. history with the passage of the National Labor Relations Act, which gives workers in the private sector the legal framework to be able to organize a union and engage in collective bargaining. And so the type of work that the School for Workers was doing in those first 10, 11, 12 years then gets rolled into mass union organizing campaigns that are occurring at the same time. And so there's more workers who are having some of the educational opportunities and benefits of unionization and looking for educational opportunities to go along with that and to partner between universities and unions to be able to provide some of that. And historically, during that time, there's a major uptick in organizing activity in the United States. We have some of the highest union density numbers ever in the U.S. during that time. And so that led to some of the early successes in being able to provide that. And then, as Don said, moving forward, the School for Workers has evolved to meet the needs of changing workforces and the changing dynamic of what that landscape looks like.
When you say union density, you mean more people join unions? There are more unions in Wisconsin during this time?
Correct. And nationally as well, there's more people who are members of unions, particularly in the private sector.
And with the Great Depression and FDR's New Deal and so on, how did that have an impact on the School for Workers?
Well, to expand on what Erica just said, that when the National Labor Relations Act was passed in 1935, which was a big part of the New Deal, part of it was, it's often thought of as a pro-union, and it is, but it wasn't simply passed to do something advantageous for unions. It was recognized at the time that unionized workers make better money and they spend it back into the economy. So it was an economic recovery tool to help workers unionize. And you could see in our historical materials that prior to the 1930s or the mid-30s, the School for Workers was we hosted conferences bringing together workers and farmers and policymakers trying to figure out a way forward given the economic depression. But once workers, a little bit before the passage of the act, but certainly after, particularly in manufacturing, in mass industry, where there were largely no unions in the 1920s, millions of workers formed and joined unions. And so the School for Workers shifted into that space really quickly, and Wisconsin was a major manufacturing state, and so these enormous, maybe I'm stereotyping a little bit, but enormous assembly line workforces had almost an immediate need for developmental assistance and representational training and leadership training and things that the School for Workers was already largely equipped to provide. So we expanded into that space rapidly.
This might be an odd question, but in some ways, it almost seems like everyone should be included in the School for Workers, anyone working at anything, including at the university. But this would be a separate, in other words, you'd have the University of Wisconsin teaching its undergraduates in a degree program, but the School for Workers would be outside of that, not leading to a degree, but helping non-traditional students, presumably working adults without degrees mostly, to get skills and training and what they needed as workers?
Yeah. The School for Workers has always been more or less an extension type operation, although we haven't always been part of extension. We've been in and out of UW extension, but at least until we had a reorganization 5 or 6 years ago, we were in extension, and the work that we did was very very much aligned with the extension mission, which is non-credit community development, and our focus being workers.
And I think as well that positions the School for Workers as one of the programs departments that the university has that epitomizes the Wisconsin idea, because it is uniquely positioned in that space to be part of the university, to be working on campus, but also to be reaching community members all across the state and beyond, to bring them onto campus, to go on site where they are and provide education or engage in research, scholarship, and collaboration in a way that I think is unique outside of some of the more traditional academic departments on universities.
We're going to talk more about the School for Workers when we return in a moment with the University of the Year.
We tried for an atmosphere of freedom, of informality, so that workers could overcome their awe of a highbrow environment and think naturally. We tried getting away from formalized subject matter and dealt instead with the stuff of everyday experience. What shall be the next developments in teaching methods? Who knows? But the school will keep on trying to feel the need of the hour.
That's Alice Shoemaker, the first director of the School for Workers. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Erica Wills and Don Taylor, and we are talking about the 100-year tradition of the UW's School for Workers. I understand Alice Shoemaker didn't last as the director. Tell me about that.
No, unfortunately, you know, I suppose like many organizations with long histories, you have things in your past that happened that weren't the most positive things. And Alice was the first director of the School for Workers. But when the university fully took in the School for Workers, she was replaced. And unfortunately, I don't remember his name, and I should because he was director for quite a while. But she was replaced with a man and was made his assistant. And I don't think she stayed very long after that, nor would I have.
That seems really ironic somehow that if you have a woman who's trying to be a champion of workers and has been in this role and then is removed simply because she's a woman and then relegated to assistant status, that kind of epitomizes some of the problems that are inherent. It also seems to me that there's a irony in having workers attend the School for Workers classes while on the main UW-Madison campus in the School for Business, you have CEOs being trained. What is the relationship over time between the School for Workers and departments of business?
Well, for us specifically, it's been mostly amicable. In fact, the labor relations class at the School of Business is taught by us. And we're very proud of that. And in recent years, we've also been the instructors for the labor law class at the law school. So although we don't offer a degree program internally or credit, although we're working on that, we are able to teach credit classes for other departments like the School of Business. So there, as far as I know, there's never been any particular controversy. There have been occasions in the past when, for example, I think it was the continuing education division at UW-Milwaukee decided they were going to teach a class specifically on how businesses can get rid of unions. And it was more the local labor movement than us who kicked up a storm about that and I think got the class canceled. But
sometimes labor unions have been controversial.
Oh, of course.
Particularly their involvement in politics, where they'll endorse a candidate as if they're speaking for everyone that belongs to the union, or whether you have to be in a union. When I think of labor, I picture picket lines, scabs, kind of these the controversy over how does a union survive when an organization is trying to do it in. How has your School for Workers handled the teaching of unions in a way that somehow acknowledges that controversy?
Well, I think one thing that's important to acknowledge initially is that unions are, at their best, a democratic institution. And this makes them very different from a traditional business organization, for instance. Usually members vote for their local leadership, and then there's often regional leadership and then national leadership. And it's really an extension of the democratic ideas and processes into the workplace. The idea that if you believe in a democratic society, if you're committed to those goals and ideals, it should not end at the workplace door. It should have an extension where workers, as well as management and owners and CEOs have a voice in what that workplace is and what it does. And I think that assertion and that shared space of power in and of itself is very up for interpretation. And some people believe that that has a place and some do not. And so I think that that positions it oftentimes politically and historically within a different context that there is debate and different perspectives over.
What about you, Don, or with other people within your department, if they are teaching the history of unions and they're doing so in the School of Business or the law school, how do you kind of tell the complex story of unions?
Well, you know, the history is the history, right? And it may be controversial to teach the things that actually happened, and when you look at the history, if you're being honest with students, workers as students, the fact is that workers in the United States and most other industrialized countries haven't gotten a particularly fair shake from any political party except the ones they've built themselves, and even those go off the rails, it seems, eventually. And so that's the honest, to me anyway, the honest place to teach from. If their union is then going to tell them you need to vote for candidate A over candidate B, that doesn't come into my classroom. One, because I don't think it's our place as labor educators, but it's certainly not our place as state employees, right, to take a political position of that sort. But if we're going to teach workers about globalization, for example, I taught globalization to a room full of Boilermakers Union members this week, and understanding the political forces behind globalization and neoliberalism and other big scary things like that. The fact of the matter is that most of our institutions and political parties have been enveloped by it, and that's what. In order for workers to develop their own voice, either individually or collectively, they need to understand how these mechanisms are actually functioning in their community and in their world.
And Don just mentioned workers developing their own voice. And I think one way to address what you talked about with how we teach labor history is that oftentimes when we're in a classroom, the participants have had history in maybe, you know, elementary, high school, even higher education. And oftentimes it can be a top-down history. It can be sort of like the series that the History Channel ran that was The Men Who Built America. Mm-hmm. And it was about
the great leaders.
It was about the great leaders. It was about the Gilded Age, the Rockefeller and Carnegie and those. And another way to go about teaching history, and specifically to and with workers, is to include the voices of the people in the room, to learn about their experiences and their interests, and then to look at history through the perspective of workers' voices, which is a different way of going about that, sometimes in a way that draws in specifically when we're talking about adults, continuing education, people who have had time in the workforce, to be able to understand these historical voices, to be able to understand that some of the struggles or the multiple perspectives or the ideas or even the political positions that they are navigating currently have a long historical trajectory that are often reflected in workers' voices that are sometimes more difficult to tease out and find and integrate in the classroom, and then the more sort of mainstream history that people have learned in maybe K through 12 education.
I would think, too, as you're adding in those voices or considering them over time, that it would overlap with a history of racism, that whether you look at Chinese laborers or the Mexican migrant workers and Cesar Chavez, or, you know, who was doing the work, how were they treated, and what ways does that come into some of the classes and research and publications within the School for Workers?
I think that you brought up a very important point and something that oftentimes is not represented in maybe the initial image of a union worker that people have in their mind, maybe a man in a hard hat with a lunchbox on an assembly line, and he may be white, for example. And so to teach labor history and union history and to engage with that today, we have to recognize all the diversity and complexities of historically and contemporary populations. Right now, some of my work is with, I'm working on a book that talks about the contemporary United Mine Workers of America, the union that represents the vast majority of coal miners in the United States. And oftentimes people hear of that and they think of a white, male, Appalachian coal miner.
That's what came in my mind.
That's
so
what
yes.
came in your mind, yes. And that is true, and that is a very important population to engage with. But the United Mine Workers and mining as an industry and coal mining specifically is much more diverse than that. So much of my work has been in southern Colorado, where there is a large population of coal miners who their families may have lived in southern Colorado from the time that that was part of Mexico. And that is part of their heritage. And it is different than the traditional stereotypical image. Also, I'm doing work on the Navajo Nation, which I mentioned. And many of the union leaders of the coal mines before they closed down the union coal mines, they were Navajo women. And that's a very different image. That's a very different cultural surrounding and perspective than what we typically think of. And I think that part of what my work does, and I think what we appreciate through the School for Workers, is providing educational resources, but also scholarship and research that communicates with those populations, that shares their stories, and that shows the complexity of what the U.S. workforce looks like historically, with the overlap between the civil rights movement and the labor movement, the farm worker movement and the labor movement, a variety of things, you know, the women's movement and the labor movement, as well as what that looks like today in the diverse populations that need to be recognized and included, and their voices need to be integrated into the type of, I believe, integrated into the type of research and scholarship that we're doing, as well as providing the public-facing and public writing that is accessible, not behind paywalls, not just in academic journals or books, but to those populations so that they have access to that information as well.
There's a novel by Dickens called Hard Times where the workers are referred to as the hands. And it's that dehumanization that can happen where you can talk about workers as if they're sort of a faceless mob. So I think what you're alluding to, Erica, is also trying to get the stories, the sort of human faces, human stories, kind of make the people who are doing the work known for more than the work that's produced.
Absolutely. I think that helps us understand the impact of things as large and abstract as policy decisions on individuals, on families, on communities, what that looks like when we humanize what a workforce is, when we recognize people as complex individuals who are part of their communities, who are perhaps part of their labor union, part of perhaps religious organizations and all of these things, and they're coming to work. And so it helps. I think one of my missions and one of the things is we believe in the dignity of work and the dignity of workers and upholding their human rights. And part of that is to see them as people, as complex individuals, and recognize that.
What about in your work, Don? And in what way would you say you are shattering stereotypes or bringing more voices into the conversation?
Well, in a lot of my teaching, I bring this question to a group of workers in the form of questions on my own, where I help them to first point out that their goal is typically to achieve as much as they possibly can, to win. And if they want to win, they want maximum power. You know, serious demands require maximum strength. And if I then ask, well, what about the third shift in the foundry that's all Spanish speakers? Are they coming to meetings? Well, no. Well, is that hurting you? And trying to, you know, rather than preaching to them about, you know, the virtues of diversity, getting them to understand that it's literally a matter of a power equation. If you want to be stronger, you need to engage all workers, and everybody's voice needs to be in the room, whether it's the third shift foundry, Hispanics that I just mentioned, or women, or workers of high seniority, workers of low seniority. Getting them to see very directly that their ability to achieve what they want to achieve depends on them proactively including everybody, and not just giving them a vote at the meeting, but including them in a very democratic, participatory way.
One of the terms that certainly has come up in Wisconsin a lot is collective bargaining, and we're going to talk about that and other labor issues when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air.
When the union's inspiration through the workers' blood shall run, there can be no power greater anywhere beneath the sun. Yet what force on earth is weaker than the feeble strength of one? But the union makes us strong. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever, for the union makes us strong. Is there aught we hold in common with the greedy parasite who would lash us into serfdom and would crush us with his might? Is there anything left to us but to organize and fight? For the union makes us strong. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. For the union makes us strong. It is we who plowed the prairies, built the cities where they trade, dug the mines and built the workshops, endless miles of railroad laid. We stand outcast and starve amidst the wonders we have made, but the union makes us strong. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. For the union makes us strong. All the world that's owned by idle drones is ours and ours alone. We have laid the wide foundation, built it skyward stone by stone. It is ours not to slave in, but to master and to own, while the union makes us strong.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Don Taylor and Erica Wills, two faculty members from the UW School for Workers, which is celebrating its 100th anniversary. One of the ways that labor really took on headlines here in Wisconsin was with big protests at the Capitol, thousands of people over Act 10 and the question of collective bargaining. Can you tell us what is that all about, Act 10, collective bargaining? Why was it such a hot issue at that point?
Well, for public employees, governmental employees, other than federal, what rights they have is set by state statute, and it varies from place to place. We essentially have 50 or 51, if you count Puerto Rico, laboratories or rule books, and some states have very extensive. I don't know if I would go so far as to say generous, but very extensive collective bargaining laws. Other states have none. Some states prohibit collective bargaining by state, county, municipal employees. So Wisconsin had actually been the very first, back in 1959, to grant legal collective bargaining rights to local government employees, like teachers and local social workers and highway road crews and whoever else works for local government. And so after the 2010 election, Governor Walker and the Republicans in Congress announced their intent to propose to eliminate most of those rights. And that's what Act 10 was the eradication of most of what existed in state law in terms of collective bargaining for public employees. And that's why tens of thousands of public employees, I think 25 school districts closed because so many teachers had called in sick to come and protest at the Capitol. They were ultimately successful. And so the aftermath of that since the law passed in 2011 has been, for lack of a better word, I would say the withering of public sector unions. They're still alive and they still have, a lot of influence in some places, but certainly nowhere close to what they once had.
I realize that I don't know necessarily which kinds of professions belong to unions. I know in a write-up I saw about your work, Erica, you had talked about working with people from steelworkers to teachers, miners to flight attendants, you know, many different fields. Are you mostly working with those who are in unions?
So my work is often with union members and in collaboration, though, with the unions themselves, the workers, and also the communities that they're in. Because just as I spoke about, we need to understand workers as more than just disembodied hands or a disembodied mind or as the complex individuals that they are, we also need to recognize the ways that they interact with and support their communities and the ways that policy decisions and economic changes can oftentimes leave workers behind, and sometimes in great regional swaths. So we can look at policy changes that have impacted different sectors of workers or different types of professions, as well as one of my areas of work in mining, the way that the implementation of coal phase out and energy transition has impacted from Appalachia to the Navajo Nation, and not just the workers, but left communities devastated. We see this in the auto industry, in certain communities, in traditional manufacturing, in areas where the economic changes and policy hand in hand have impacted the families and the communities. And to go into those spaces means that we need to, I believe, collaborate with workers, with community needs, and with the organizations that represent those workers to be able to best provide education and do the types of research and scholarship that can help create real and lasting change to build up and bring up those communities to the standard that they have been and they should be and they deserve, as well as looking moving forward, how do we respect workers and families and communities and the type of policy and economic decisions that we're making to make sure that no one is left behind.
Don, in your position as chair of the School for Workers, you kind of are overseeing many different faculty members and academic staff in the different projects. Can you share with us some of the work being done right now in your department, some of the faculty projects and areas that would be under the umbrella of the School for Workers?
Absolutely, and it's more varied all the time. This does connect back to our history a little bit, and some intentionality that got us to where we are. Because when Wisconsin was a major manufacturing state, and 20% or more of workers in Wisconsin were in unions, that gave us plenty of work to do, and so we primarily developed projects and had faculty who had experience with unions, who could work with unions. I suppose am a late stage example of that.
Right, because you were a union leader.
Came from the labor movement. I often like to tell my classes that I've even been a union president and lost my re-election by one vote in an election that I forgot to vote in.
that's funny.
that's why
funny
I'm always
or sad.
Yeah, maybe I did myself a favor. But the percentage of the workforce that's in a union is certainly not as high as it once was. It peaked at about 35% in the United States, but is now at about 10%. In Wisconsin, it's now at about 6%.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's fallen by about half since 2014.
And why?
Primarily Act 10.
Okay.
And in the private sector, ongoing, factories closing, picking up moving overseas, or new technologies that eliminate labor, but primarily Act 10 and the decimation of the public sector. more than a decade ago, the School for Workers, we started reminding ourselves that we're the School for Workers, not the School for Unions. And you know, where we stand today is that 90% of the workforce is not in a union and still needs our help. And so the as I said, over a decade ago, we included in our strategic plan that we wanted future faculty hires, maybe not all, but most, to take us in new directions and hire people who could help us help the 90% of the workforce who's not in a union. So that's kind of my on-ramp talking about other faculty. We have Armando Ibarra, who has a PhD from UC Davis, and a lot of his work recently has been with workers who during the pandemic were identified as essential workers, and their rights on the job and their ability to advocate for themselves. And so he's partnered with a number of worker center and worker advocacy organizations outside of unions to develop a training program, essentially a leadership development and rights on the job training program for essential workers. It's really amazing. We also have Alexia Kulwick, who's an attorney who does a lot of work with workers in food production and distribution, as well as Lola Lustano, who's studying farm workers. And again, when I say studying, School for Workers doesn't do studying in a traditional academic way. She's out in the field talking to farm workers. And
so it's community engaged scholarship.
100%. We practically do nothing else. I don't want to overlook Michael Childers, who is our senior faculty member, who an enormous part of his work is in the deep weeds of work measurement. He's an industrial engineer, and so his work is primarily with unionized workforces. But when I'll use a very simplified example, but when the employer wants to speed up the assembly line and produces numbers to prove that the workers can achieve this work and will get paid a certain amount for doing it, sometimes the workers and the union need an expert on their side to crunch the numbers. And that's we are, I think, the last university-based labor education program in the country that has an industrial engineer on the faculty that can provide that service to workers and unions.
Do you also have academic staff that are engaged in projects beyond those faculty members?
Not engaged in projects. We do have some academic staff who form, the hub of our office. We have an office manager. We have a marketing and outreach manager because we rely on her to make sure people are aware of our programs and can sign up for them. And we have an events coordinator. So they mainly do all of the hard work so that we can just show up and teach.
Do you find that if you're out and about and someone asks what you do and you say you're with the School for Workers, do you find that people have heard of the School for Workers, or is it a little bit under the radar?
Do you want to say something about that, Erica?
Yeah, I find that oftentimes they have not heard of the School for Workers, especially in the populations that we are trying to do more to serve. And so I think our faculty, along very much with our staff, to work to get the information out to the public, to let them know the classes and the type of educational opportunities that are out there. Because as Don alluded to, our classes are not just for union members. They are for people who identify as workers, like the summer school for women workers that we just hosted, that had many workers who were not part of traditional unions and came out of a variety of different sectors that unionization is not particularly high in.
People who were union curious.
They were. Yes, they were. And so we talked about that, but a lot of it had to do with workers' rights, with legal aspects, with the history and certain things that have broad applicability. And I wish that more people knew about the unique opportunities that are available through the School for Workers on campus and in their own communities.
And since you had an 80th anniversary, you had a 100th anniversary, if you can imagine a 120th anniversary, what do you think might have occurred in the School for Workers? I know this is hypothetical, but if you can imagine the direction that the School for Workers might go in, especially with AI moving in and with just other things that could happen, any thoughts on the future?
Well, I suppose the optimistic way to envision the future would I guess, would be twofold. One, at least for the School for Workers, I think all of us would prefer to see the union movement have a better, you know, getting back to where it once was. It would be beneficial to all workers if the labor movement was as strong as it was in the 50s and 60s.
So greater union density,
getting back to, who knows, 30% of the workforce. But also for us specifically, having found numerous successful ways to engage the non-union population, which we're still figuring out. Because even when we get back to 35% union density, that's going to leave 65% of workers without an easy way for us to reach or for them to find out about us. And so in a perfect world, we will have figured that out to a greater extent than we have so far.
One of the things that I can see continuing and being part of that celebration is a continued commitment to democracy. And specifically, our slogan is Education for Workplace Democracy. And I see that being very much a guiding principle in what we do and moving us forward by recognizing the importance of that in the workplace and beyond, and making sure that all workers have a voice in that process.
I see on the website for the School for Workers that your mission is defined as, we advance the empowerment of working people, labor organizations, and community partners through teaching, research, and service. Your vision is, we envision a just and equitable society rooted in economic democracy, in which all workers have a meaningful impact in their workplaces and communities. That seems like some pretty good goals. And so whether you're studying sneakers and what happened there, or Navajo coal miners, or
absolutely.
That there's a place for bringing out the stories of workers and trying to move toward a more just world.
Absolutely. And to circle back to the Wisconsin idea, you know, our mission and vision that you just read, Emily, it really illustrates how we're, you know, not to overstate it, but we're kind of an exemplar of the Wisconsin idea, because this isn't just about UW-Madison. It isn't even just about factories and offices and other people, his hospitals, other people's workplaces. It's about, you know, raising workers' voices everywhere in the state, and, you know, in their communities, in their churches, in their families, and you know, it is about democracy and empowerment.
And I think before we go out on the School for Workers song, now this is an original song by folk singer Ann Feeney, created for your 80th anniversary. Before we hear more of that, I just want to thank my two guests, Erica Wells and Don Taylor, for sharing your excitement, commitment to the School for Workers. I'm Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.
Sarah.